It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, an art exhibit in Wisconsin is looking back at a period when the U.S. government employed thousands of artists when times were tough.
First, Governor Walker and Republican lawmakers are at odds with each other over the governor's budget. Disagreements came to a head last night in a budget committee meeting when GOP lawmakers voiced concerns that state roads would continue to deteriorate under the governor's budget.
Walker's Transportation Secretary Dave Ross faced tough criticism during the meeting. Here's Republican Assembly Representative John Nigro of Marinette.
How do you, as the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, feel good with a budget that is not meeting our priorities, leading an organization that's going to see the further decline of our roads and have them become less safe?
Republican Budget Committee members also criticized the governor's plan to add more auditors to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Once again, here's John Nigren.
I think that there is a lot of frustration with debt collectors, auditors, whatever the case may be. It's almost, from a lot of my colleagues in the Assembly's position, this is almost right up there with a tax increase. I mean, the way they view this.
WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us now. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, this is the latest installment in something we've talked about before, the tiff between Governor Walker and some, not all, but some of his Republican colleagues over in the legislature. What did we see yesterday?
Yeah, you did see it really come to the surface with a couple agencies in particular, transportation and then the Department of Revenue. Transportation, that we've known about for a long time, particularly with Assembly Republicans and their issues with Governor Walker's transportation budget, particularly that it would delay a lot of projects, doesn't include any, you know, long-term changes to the way we fund roads, so no tax increase, no fee increase, nothing like that, and it grows debt. So they voiced those concerns again last night. But you also heard them talking about with the Department of Revenue, which was up before the committee in a budget briefing, they really don't like these auditors or these tax collectors that Governor Walker wants to add to the budget. He added 102 auditors in the last budget, and there are some Republican lawmakers who feel like those auditors are out there basically pestering businesses. The Department of Revenue under Walker says, hey, they're actually out there just collecting taxes that are due. And if we don't go out and get those taxes, somebody else is going to have to pay them.
Yeah, I've seen someone was citing that we're seeing more tax fraud at the state and federal level. That's one of the arguments for these auditors. But what are lawmakers concerned about? They're just thinking, no, it's not fraud. No, it's not unpaid taxes.
They feel like, I mean, I can't say this is all lawmakers, but you hear John Nigren there. He's kind of speaking on behalf of his caucus. So there are enough in the caucus that have made this an issue. Mm-hmm. And I know some of them have said they wouldn't vote for a budget that increases auditors again because they feel like these auditor positions are out there looking for trouble with businesses. Again, the Department of Revenue says that's not what they're there for, that they're out there, that if they're going after a business, it's because that business or that person hasn't paid taxes that they were supposed to. So, you know, essentially they're enforcing the law. Republican lawmakers don't view it that way. They think it's more of a tax increase because this would bring in, you know, the governor's proposal this year to add these new positions this year brings in about $32 million a year. So essentially these new auditing positions are helping to balance that budget. And there are some Republican lawmakers that don't like that.
I know we're early in the budget process. Have we started to see lobbyists or business groups weigh in on things like this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, lobbyists are involved, I think, from start. They're involved before the budget is introduced until the last day that it makes it, you know, that it's signed, you know, until the ink is dry. they have a stake in there. And that's particularly true on the transportation budget. Road builders have traditionally or used to traditionally get a lot of what they want of what they wanted in Wisconsin that hasn't. And I'm not sure that's going to be the case in this budget. There are big projects that were on the books in varying stages of development that Governor Scott Walker would delay in some cases indefinitely. So an expansion of I-94 west of Milwaukee, a big priority of the business community in Milwaukee. That is essentially shelved. An expansion of I-39/90/94 north of Madison that was going to happen in the long term, Governor Walker's administration has said, no, we're not going to do that. An expansion of or a rebuild of the northern portion of the Zoo interchange in Milwaukee. Governor Walker was going to do that. That was a priority. Now he's putting that off. So these are all areas where the road building lobby is trying to get lawmakers to rewrite the governor's budget, but it's going to be tough.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, about some tiffs among Republicans over the governor's budget proposal, issues including transportation, tax auditors, and more. Staying with transportation, Sean, I've seen kind of a new line of attack here in a way from some of the governor's people. The argument in the past was over, you know, do we need to raise revenue? We're going to have a shortfall if we don't raise revenue. The argument I think I'm hearing from Secretary Ross, among others, is actually the problem is we overcommitted ourselves in the past. Our eyes were bigger than our budget stomach, if you will. We committed ourselves to these big, expensive highway projects that cost more than we thought, and we can't pay for them.
Yeah, I think that yesterday's hearing was noteworthy for a couple reasons. You know, the Ross being kind of peppered with criticism, as you heard from Representative Nygren earlier, that was noteworthy. But also Secretary Ross, who was hired to this position in late December, was pretty blunt in his assessment of how he felt the DOT had misled lawmakers over the years. He said it's not the fault of governors or legislators. He said, we just told you these projects were going to cost less than they actually cost. So he compared it to selling somebody a house and saying it's going to cost $20,000. And then the bill comes and it's $30,000. This showed up in a recent audit. There are 16 ongoing highway projects in Wisconsin. Costs for those had more than doubled. And so you're talking about cost overruns of $3.1 billion. That's what Secretary Ross is focused on exclusively. And he was telling lawmakers, we can't do new projects until these current projects are done. That did not sit well because you're talking about putting off any new projects until 2024, roughly.
And then the issue of a gas tax, some Assembly Republicans had said, not necessarily that we should do that, a gas tax increase, but we should keep it on the table. Governor said, I guess he said repeatedly, he would veto this. It seems like this is probably just not going to happen.
It would be very tough for Republicans who want a gas tax to get that done, just given the dynamics of this budget and the hardline stand that the governor has taken. And I think that the governor's position has evolved on this, too. You look back in September of last year when he introduced his budget, he indicated that he was kind of open to raising gas taxes or fees if there could be a corresponding tax cut somewhere else in the budget. So revenues came in better than expected, and a lot of Republican lawmakers said, hey, we can do that. We can cut taxes in the general fund so we can increase taxes in the transportation fund. And now the governor is saying, no, I'm not going to do that. And last night when they were talking about potentially raising gas taxes, Governor Walker tweeted a veto threat, said, if you do that, I'm going to veto that. And kind of a side note on that, Republican Senator Luther Olson was saying during discussions, we need to bite the bullet and raise revenues. There was Senator Steve Noss, a fellow Republican, put out a statement almost immediately saying, Senator Noss does not speak for me.
Or Senator Olson.
Senator Olson does not speak for me. Thank you for correcting me. And so Olson actually walked it back over the course of the meeting. I think that shows you the pressure that those Republican lawmakers face. You hear today Senator Fitzgerald also weighing in on this, said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to go against the governor's wishes on this.
I want to take a quick look at another smaller budget item. And speaking of Republican Senator Luther Olson of Ripon, he was raising concerns about the governor's plans for a brief sales tax holiday for school supplies. Here's Senator Olson.
I wanted to talk about the sales tax holiday. You're taking a certain group of people and giving them a tax break on 2 days, and the rest of the population be damned.
So some pushback on this school supply sales tax holiday.
Yeah, Senator Olson called it a gimmick. Senator Howard Markline spoke later. He called it a gimmick.
Also a Republican.
Also a Republican. I think more conservative than Senator Olson. So you're seeing a variety of perspectives agree on this one. It would cost the state roughly $11 million a year in lost revenue. And while it's being billed as a back-to-school sales tax holiday, you wouldn't have to buy you know, the stuff that's covered for students. So if you're out there buying clothes or office supplies or computers under a certain dollar amount, anybody would get that sales tax holiday, and it would cost, you know, the state $22 million over the next couple of years. So a lot of Republican lawmakers have said they don't want to go that direction. And if they're looking for ways to find money in the budget, that might be one that they choose.
We'll leave that there for now, Sean, but I'm sure we'll be checking in with you as the budget moves forward.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, talking about Governor Walker's disagreements with Republican lawmakers over transportation funding and some tax issues. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says we have a lot to learn about how we learn. He shares the latest research and advice on how we can learn more effectively.
First, it's no secret that it can be hard to find opportunities that pay you to make art. But there was a time when the U.S. government did just that. Back in the 1930s and 40s, the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, put unemployed Americans to work under the New Deal, and that included artists.
Some WPA art gives a glimpse into one of the most challenging times in American history, the Great Depression. And those works have found a home here in Wisconsin. The Racine Art Museum has its collection of WPA art on display through June 4th. Lena Vigna joins us now. She's the curator of exhibitions at the Racine Art Museum. Lena, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we start with some background on this initiative to hire artists under the Works Progress Administration?
Sure. So right after the Great Depression, the country was suffering immeasurably, and there were many federal programs to initiate actual job relief, as well as to encourage sort of philosophical and psychological address of what had been going on in the country to get people a little bit more motivated to move forward and to feel like they were being supported in order to do that. So the government, I should say, not without a lot of argument, debate, a lot of the same kinds of conflicts that we might have heard about recently and in the last decades were at play even then. But there was this desire to support artists, not to say build a road, but to actually support them as artists with this notion that what they did could contribute to the greater good. So the government established through the Works Progress Administration and then through things like the Federal Art Project. So you have both the acronyms of the WPA and the FAP, initiatives that allowed artists to produce work, get supplies. They were basically in relief programs with the focus being on art production. And this was visual arts, performing arts. So it was a broad spectrum of performing arts, et cetera, et cetera. It was a broad spectrum of artistic endeavor.
Now, this idea of a starving artist is still a trope that's in play today. Can you tell us a little more about the federal government's rationale behind hiring artists?
Sure. I think I would add that anybody that was an artist that was a part of this program, it's not as if they were getting rich through this. They were struggling in the same way that other people would be struggling, engineers, construction workers, et cetera, et cetera. But there really was this strong desire to increase positivity on a lot of fronts. And it seemed as if there were enough artists producing and enough artists working and enough support, again, not without some conflict, but enough support to put programs in place that would allow the artists to keep working. And as I was just reading about some things recently, I realized, too, that it wasn't a smooth process by any means. Things that were established at the beginning, which would, say, be in the mid-30s, they were not at play the whole of the run of the WPA. Lots of dynamics changed. States were given a lot of liberty in some respects and then had to, of course, adhere to certain guidelines in other ways. And some states were doing that, say, quote-unquote, better than others, et cetera, et cetera. But there really was this desire to focus on this idea that we need to get past this really difficult place on more than one level. So we need to do that on a cultural level, on a social level, on a basic economic level, et cetera, et cetera.
So this collection that you're exhibiting now is from this work, from the Works Progress Administration. Can you tell us about some of the core pieces in that collection and the scope of what you have?
Absolutely. So when the Racine Art Museum first opened, it was in actually 2003, but our parent institution, the Worcester Museum of Fine Arts, opened in 1941. And the initial director, this is all important because the initial director had come from a WPA program in Michigan. So he was an artist himself, but he was also a part of administrating it. And his wife was also a part of a WPA program called the Index of American Design. That had been in play to establish basically a record of decorative craft and art and furniture and design that had been at play in the U.S. since the colonial period. So he was significant in bringing the lens of the WPA to the Worcester Museum, and at that time, a gift of 264 pieces came. This includes works on paper, such as watercolor, drawings, prints, photographs, a few paintings, a few small sculpture pieces, and then several pieces from the Wisconsin Handicraft Project, which includes textiles and handmade books and things of that nature that were not produced by artists from the WPA specifically, but from this Handicraft Project directly. That's sort of a subset of the WPA being administered in the state of Wisconsin. So in the exhibition right now, we primarily have the works on paper, multiple watercolors, and series of photographs, and then also selections of textiles from the Handicraft Project.
We're talking with Alina Vigna right now, curator of exhibitions at the Racine Art Museum, and we're talking about art from the Great Depression that's on display now through June 4th. At the Racine Art Museum. And Lena, you mentioned the Milwaukee Handicraft Project. This is something we may not know a lot about. Tell us about that project and what's in it.
Sure. So in Milwaukee, in the 30s, there was a large population of immigrants, many, many, many people who were not necessarily used to working in the general sphere, like a lot of women. They were not necessarily the breadwinners, but through some of the federal programs that were in play at the time, and then again, federal siphons down to state programs, people who were not necessarily the breadwinners of the households were encouraged to get out to make more money. So the Handicraft Project actually focused on people who wouldn't necessarily normally have been considered for jobs. And while the workers were not art-trained, they were, or craft-trained specifically, they were put into programs that allowed them to make block-printed textiles and wall hangings. They were working through projects that were requests from institutions like nurseries or sometimes they were making costumes for theater departments, and they would work in teams with designers who were from places around Milwaukee, like a teacher's college, and they were used to addressing large groups of people toward a certain end, like making a project. So the interesting thing about this is that it garnered a lot of attention from people like Frank Lloyd Wright and Eleanor Roosevelt, because it went national, because there were so many people that were involved in the program that were not necessarily on the front lines normally. So it was this way to empower people through work, through craft. And a lot of the people who would start, say, in one division of the Milwaukee Handicraft Project, if they got really skilled, they could be moved into other divisions of the WPA. There were sewing projects, more specific and directed endeavors, and because there was such a need throughout the community for things that would just make life a little bit better. In the nurseries, they were sometimes providing dolls for the young children to learn and also just to have as things that could be a part of their daily existence. Those things weren't necessarily available in other avenues, so the Handicraft Project was put into play and given these tasks to sort of help make things a little bit better.
big picture, if we look at the pieces of art that came out of the Works Progress Administration, some of these pieces you have on display, if we look at that as a mirror for the psyche of the United States at that time, what do you see? What does it tell us?
It's as complex as you would imagine. There are moments of hope and optimism. There's a focus on workers. Like, say, for example, in our collection, we have three prints by a woman named Elizabeth Olds. Two of them focus on miners, coal miners, et cetera, et cetera. One of them focuses on, it's more of a caricature that looks as if it's these businessmen, sort of fat cats, people concerned with the money side. But again, a broad spectrum of humanity. You have people who are digging in garbage cans. In one print, we have that emphasized. But then in the print that I've displayed right next to it, you have people who are taking in play. So there is, it does respond to the fact that while you had such a great sort of cloud cast over the country, you also had these moments of production and these desires and hope to sort of move forward and move past what was going on. And it's interesting to note, too, that the artists that were producing, from all I can gather with the WPA, it depended on the different programs through states as to how specific of a request an artist was given. Generally, they're producing the work that they would have normally produced. It's not as if the government said, all of your work has to be about X, Y, and Z subjects. So they were expressing sort of personal concerns, responding to things that were going on sort of globally and culturally, and then also just trying to make their work.
Lena, thank you so much for joining us.
No, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That was Lena Vigna, curator of exhibitions at the Racine Art Museum. She joined us to talk about art from the Great Depression that's on display now through June 4th.
You can also see the exhibit for free if you go to the museum on one of its free days. The next one's on Friday, April 7th.
Coming up after the news, our guest says we can learn how to learn. He shares the latest research on how to acquire new skills and knowledge and how not to. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin poet laureate who recently won the Brittingham Prize in Poetry.
Now, think back to a time when you were trying to learn something. Middle school math, maybe. The new software at work. Throwing a curveball. How quickly did you learn how to do it? Was it easy or a struggle? What helped you figure it out? What made it more frustrating?
Our next guest says there's a good chance you could have learned it better. In a new book, he shares recent research on how people learn, what works and what doesn't, and he shares advice that we can use when we learn stuff at school, work, and in our daily lives.
Ulrich Boser joins us now. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. His new book is Learn Better, Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, Business, and School, or How to Become an Expert in Just About Anything. Ulrich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Happy to join you.
Well, people may be surprised by the idea that we can learn how to learn. Is that true? We can learn to learn better?
We can definitely learn how to learn better. There are simply a lot of myths about learning. People believe that people have learning styles, that they are visual learners or auditory learners, and it turns out not to be true. I see people using highlighters all the time in business and in schools, and it turns out there's actually very little evidence behind the highlighters. And there is evidence for some other approaches, and there's a lot of new research about how we can improve our ability at gaining new skills in more effective ways.
Now, before we get to some of the practical advice, what does it mean to learn something? Does it mean we've memorized a bunch of facts or we've learned concepts or how facts interrelate? How are we defining what it means to learn as we learn how to learn?
Sure. when we learn something, for the most part, we want to become experts, and that means, you know, our ability to solve new problems. And in the book, I talk actually about the Car Talk guys. That's familiar, of course, to a lot of NPR listeners. And, you know, when you looked past their jokes and goofy nature, you know, they did something that was really very impressive, right? Someone would call in about a Buick and say that there was some white smoke and maybe an odd noise. And just from that, right, they never saw the Buick. They were able to diagnose the problem. And that's really why we, whether we're learning middle school math or, knitting, we want to be able to learn, have these skills to solve problems and use them when we need to.
One thing we hear a lot, this was a big a while back, the idea of 10,000 hours. You want to become an expert in something, put in 10,000 hours of practice at it. I learned from your book, though, it isn't so much how much practice as is it the right kind of practice? What's the right kind of practice and learning to develop those skills?
You know, it's interesting because time doesn't always equal learning. There are all sorts of things like handwriting, for instance, that we do a lot, less than perhaps in the past, but we don't necessarily get better at it. Driving is a wonderful example. Myself, as well as many of my friends and colleagues, you know, drive about as well as they did when they were 18. And, you know, so what makes people get better at something? And, you know, what turns out to be true, what the research makes clear is that feedback and monitoring are really, really important. I saw this myself. I played a lot of, you know, basketball. On a league with some friends. And, you know, I noticed that, you know, even among the kind of middle-aged beer belly guys, I was particularly middle-aged and beer bellied. And, you know, I decided, you know, I should hire a basketball tutor. And what was amazing to me is that I was writing a book on learning. I've been writing about education, since the late 90s. And I was even surprised at just how helpful it was to get that feedback, immediately improved my game, and it fits with a lot of the research that, you know, how we practice is often more important than what we practice or even the hours that we put in.
Talking to Ulrich Boser, his new book is called Learn Better. He looked at the science of learning. He's sharing some advice on how to get better at acquiring skills and knowledge. Ulrich, one thing that was interesting to me was sort of the window of opportunity you talk about, the sweet spot. A lot of people will either, when they're learning something, go over the stuff that's really easy, or bite off more than they could chew, go to something that's too hard. You say the key is find that stuff that's just pushing us a little more each time. How do we find that sweet spot?
Yeah, researchers talk about this idea of desirable difficulty, that, you know, it's important that learning is a little bit difficult for us. And look, you know, I'm like most people, I want things actually to be easy. It's just simply more fun that way. But pushing ourselves a little bit out of our comfort zone is important, and we see this in all sorts of areas. So there's a lot of research now that quizzing yourself, self-testing yourself, is a great way to learn. It's a good way to learn facts by bringing them out of memory. You get a better sense of them, and it's actually a good way to develop, you know, richer sense of expertise because you're often making connections. And, you know, what's key there, though, is that it's making learning a little bit difficult for ourselves. We don't want to go too far, of course, and get overwhelmed. But this idea that, you know, learning isn't necessarily always going to be fun. We want it to be just a little bit hard for ourselves.
You mentioned learning not always fun, and you break down some steps to think about. And the first one you share is the idea of value. We have to want to learn. How do we, as educators, maybe as parents and as learners, assign a value to that thing we're going to learn to motivate us to do it in the first place?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because ultimately, it's very hard to learn something if you don't want to learn it. We see that in kids. We see that in ourselves. And what I found fascinating about this research is, you know, just telling people that something is important is not enough. And, you know, to a degree, we know this. We all get these emails, you know, from our HR department that says, you know, we should worry about our 401ks. And certainly a lot of us as parents might tell that to our kids, you know, this is going to be important someday. But it turns out that making this type of meaning is really a one-way street. It goes from the student to the material. And a lot of research now shows that, you know, just giving students a piece of paper and saying, you know, why is this math going to be important for you is a way to spark interest. because it's a way to make that material meaningful for the students themselves.
Let's talk about trying to learn from a book or a text. You mentioned one misconception is the idea that highlighting works. Apparently it doesn't. Rereading, reading over and over again, apparently, isn't the ticket either. So when we're trying to learn from a textbook or an instruction manual or whatever, what's the best way to make sure we're getting something out of that?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Highlighters, not much evidence for underlining, too, which is, you know, a practice that I and many other people have used for a long time. Very little evidence for. What is more important is, you know, talking yourself through the material, asking yourself questions about the material, and really sort of, you know, trying to make some connections, some ties to the material is a far more effective way, according to researchers, about learning from texts. And yet, you know, we see these other practices really done all the time. And what's key is that we're really producing our knowledge when we're engaging in that way. We are really mentally doing, and that turns out to be far more effective.
Yeah, a recurring theme in the book is the idea of connecting what we're learning to stuff we already know, whether that's in the same field or not. So making analogies to things we've already known or experienced helps us learn this new, more difficult thing.
Yeah, analogies are a funny thing. You know, we tend not to think about them all that much. For me and many others, they're sort of associated with IQ tests. But, you know, analogies end up being really important as a way to gain expertise. And when you know, I mentioned the Car Talk guy earlier, right? What they were able to do when someone would call in, they were able to use an analogy, right? They wouldn't know about your Buick and the smoke that it produced, but they thought back to other cars that they had worked on over the years and used an analogy to help them solve that problem. And, you know, we can do this ourselves by, when we're, you know, engaging in a topic, looking for more of a systems approach, not trying to learn a single fact, but how that fact might relate to other facts. Now, I found this, you know, really interesting and talked to researchers who had studied this idea in academic fields like math and history, and I thought, oh, you know, I should use something perhaps more relatable to my own life. And so I took a wine pairing class, and I found it really interesting, right? When you start thinking about a sweet wine and how it relates to spicy food, you get a much richer sense of what does it mean to be a sweet wine? Why does the sweet wine cut against the food? And, you know, that was a more analogous way of thinking about wine. And I think I took a lot more from the class than if I'd simply either tasted a few glasses of wine or read about it in a book, thinking about its relationships, its analogies to other tastes and wines.
Ulrich Boser is with us. His new book is called Learning Better. He's sharing the latest research on learning how to learn and some of the right and wrong ways to learn things at work, at school, and beyond.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What works for you and what doesn't when you're learning? Is there something you're trying to learn, a skill that you're maybe trying to acquire? Do you need some advice from our guest? Or if you teach people as a teacher, a trainer, a coach, or a parent, what have you learned about the process of learning? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we continue our conversation now with Ulrich Boser, the author of Learn Better. He says we can learn how to learn. And he's sharing advice on how to gain skills and knowledge at work, at school, and in our daily lives.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When you've learned something in your life, maybe at school, maybe a new job, maybe a hobby, a sport, what worked for you? What did you struggle with? And was there a breakthrough where you approached it in a different way and all of a sudden it clicked? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Mary is with us in Greenfield. Mary, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if your speaker had any experience in dealing with the whole learning philosophy of whole brain learning. We've been reading some books around here. A couple actually put out a few books on. One book is called No Drama Discipline, and it's basically talking about teaching kids how to learn how to retain information by their developmental age, by brain biology, as well as certain experiences. But it does mostly concentrate on having connections with the person, the parents, whoever is in charge of that, in a more loving, connecting kind of a way.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Ulrich, have you encountered this idea of whole brain learning in the past or in your research? And also, you can talk about the role of emotions in learning. You write about that.
Yeah, the whole brain learning is interesting. I'm not hugely familiar with it, but what I find interesting about, you know, the way that people talk about learning and really a lot of other things where they say, you know, it changes your brain or you're using your whole brain. I mean, everything uses your whole brain. Everything changes your brain. You know, even driving your car to work, a task that most of us do without much thinking, you know, in some small way changes your brain. And, you know, I think people, for all sorts of reasons, you know, should be a little bit reluctant sometimes around these neuromyths. But when it comes to something like your emotions in learning, I think there is a lot of evidence behind it. And to a degree, we know this ourselves. If you're really stressed, if you're really anxious, it's hard to acquire a skill. You're thinking about, you know, whatever it is that might, you know, hurt you or, you know, what might happen tomorrow. And so, you know, being calm, having moments where you're connected with other people is really centrally important. It's something that we forget, certainly in a lot of schools. But I think, you know, we as individuals forget that a lot, too. What's also interesting is that our bodies themselves are very important, and we can offload, I found this in my own research, a lot of evidence for it, you know, offload memories to our hands. I've started to do this in speaking engagements. You know, if I want to remember to thank the host, I will make sure to use a specific gesture to do that. And, you know, what we forget at a really high level is that, you know, our body and our brains, we think of them as two separate systems, but they're very interwoven, and that helps explain why we need to have connections with others. We need to feel calm and safe when we want to gain a skill, whether that's in the office or at a school.
Mary, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Julie in Cambridge. Julie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Julie?
Well, I'm in the process of studying for some licensing exams. They're pretty lengthy tests. They're several hours in length. And so I've been poring over books for a week now in the library, trying to regain and retain the information. I wondered if he had any pointers on a lot of it are going to be multiple choice types of tests. Does he have any input into the best way to study for something like that or to take a test like that?
Julie, thanks. Ulrich, any standardized test prep advice?
Yeah, you know, this is, you know, standardized tests, you know, have their own issues. But setting those aside, there are a couple of tips that I would give. One is it is very easy to forget. We forget at a very regular rate. And so to make sure that you space out your learning over time is really important, especially when it comes to factual knowledge. So, you know, what does that mean kind of practically? Anything that you can do to make sure that you revisit materials over a long period of time. There's some good software out there like Anki that can help you do that. And, you know, this spacing out over time just occurs because we forget and forget so regularly. And people who've used these tools to space our learning out over time have shown tremendous effects. In the book, I talk about a guy named Roger Craig. You know, Roger was a guy who just, you know, loved games, any type, baseball, football, Jeopardy, chess. And so he decided, you know, he was going to compete at Jeopardy, and he used this spaced approach. First, he developed some software on his own, and then he used someone else's software to spread out his learning of these Jeopardy trivia facts over time, really making sure he did everything to do the opposite of cramming. The first time he went on to Jeopardy, he blew away Ken Jennings' record using this research to memorize these trivia. When he went to bed that night, he was convinced that Alex Trebek would not invite him on the next day because he had done so well. And really what he did was use this very simple fact. You know, we forget, we easily forget these facts, especially for things like licensure exams where, you know, it's some nuanced detail. And, you know, the more that you can spread your learning out over time so that you have that material in your long-term memory when you need it, especially for these types of exams that
aren't necessarily testing your higher order thinking, but really sort of, you know, can you recall an obscure fact, whether it's, you know, for a real estate licensure exam or a police officer exam. You know, spacing out your learning is one of the fail-safe ways to improve your performance in that way.
Julie, thanks for the call. Good luck on the test. We're talking to Ulrich Boser. His new book is called Learn Better. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi, it's for Jeff Kleiber, K-L-A-I-B-E-R.
I think we have a bad connection there. We lost him. Okay, we'll go next to Mark in Chippewa Falls. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you? And thanks for having this topic on. I taught high school for 30 years in Wisconsin. And the more I went down the line, the more I knew that learning how to learn was far more the point than cramming everything in. Number one, there's no end of facts in the world, so you can't learn everything anyway. And particularly the way schools are now driven by standardized testing, it's just really a shame because kids are getting turned off to it. And the example I use with people is, listen, do you remember anything about your final exam in English when you were a senior in high school? And everybody says, no. I said, you were told it was incredibly important, right? Well, why wasn't it so important that you can't remember anything?
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. So Mark, a teacher, saying the main thing is teaching how to learn. And Ulrich, you wrote about that. You had challenges in school, and looking back, you realized that one of the challenges is you hadn't learned how to learn.
Yeah, I mean, the skill is incredibly important. You know, every time that I, you know, get a new phone, I have to learn a new skill. When I, you know, I work for all of us, you know, trying to develop new ways of looking at things become incredibly important. And so this skill of learning, you know, is incredibly important, and we often do it so wrong. So people, you know, love to block their practice so that, you know, maybe you devote one day all to one practice, and then the next day you devote to a second practice. So if I was playing basketball, for instance, maybe I would spend a whole day shooting three-pointers and then the next day shooting foul shots. Research is very clear, dating back decades, that mixing up our practice is a much better way to gain a skill like basketball or math. And so it'd be much better off, in my example, just doing mixed training, so mixing up the three-pointers and the foul shots. And, you know, what this, I think, more broadly underscores is that we haven't given people these skills of, you know, how to get better. And, you know, oftentimes they're hard. They're things that we struggle with ourselves.
Let's take one more caller. Bonnie is on the line in Verona. Bonnie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering the best way to learn a foreign language if you don't have any access to native speakers or of the language you're learning. Thanks very much.
The bane of my academic career. Ulrich, thoughts on picking up a foreign language when you're not able to immerse yourself with foreign language speakers?
Yeah, certainly immersing yourself with foreign language speakers is, you know, an incredibly powerful way to gain a skill. You know, I think what's important is, you know, when you are starting out in a subject, and this is true for, you know, learning how to dive or getting better at geometry, it's going to be really important that you master the basics so you have some fluency to build on. When it comes to foreign language, that's going to mean, you know, starting off by really practicing, you know, basic vocabulary. And then as you, you know, get better, you know, starting to think about grammar and pronunciation. And I think, you know, sometimes we have this conversation about learning where people are like, oh, well, all the information is on the internet. You can just Google it. Don't worry about learning knowledge. And we need to, I think, scale that back a little bit. Knowledge turns out to be very important to learning, and foreign languages are often a great example. Mastering that basic vocabulary is a great way to start out. But then in the end, you know, you're going to want to be able to give that language a test drive. And so you are going to need then to immerse yourself, or at very least, you know, speak with some people who are experts in that specific language or field.
Bonnie, thanks a lot for that call. And Ulrich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was an honor.
We've been talking to Ulrich Boser. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's the author of the book Learn Better, Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, business and school, or how to become an expert in just about anything. You can find out some more about what he's had to say about learning. We've got a link at the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, let us know, what are you learning right now? A new hobby, a new sport, new job skills, you're in school, the new class? Let us know. Central Time Facebook page.
Some news today from the Library of Congress. The very first episode of All Things Considered is one of more than two dozen so-called oral treasures to be inducted into its national recording registry.
According to a librarian of Congress, quote, these sounds of the past enrich our understanding of the nation's cultural history and our history in general.
So also on this list, we've got Amazing Grace, sung by Judy Collins, and American Pie by Don McLean. This is a song I really like. Rob, you're not so much in love with this song.
I used to like it. I kind of burn out on it, honestly.
It's a good one. People, this is one of your favorites, the song People by Barbara Streisand.
But David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust album is there, a favorite of mine. There's a lot, and this is, you know, of all the sounds in U.S. history, there's like 400 some, did I read that right? Total in this registry. It's just a handful being added every year. So it's got to be really significant to make this cut.
It's quite an honor for sure. And then looking at the picture of the very first crew of All Things Considered, it's worth checking out just for the hairstyles, I'm going to say.
It was a different time. Another song added to that registry, We Are Family by Sister Sledge, takes us out to the news here on Central Time.